Grayson Men is my recollection of, as Rick said, 40 months as guest of the Imperial Japanese Army and some of their better Hiltons in the Far East. I mean, my military career began because I received a reserve commission from Michigan State back in 39. And took a job after graduation with Great Lakes Steel in Detroit, setting up their first spectrographic lab. And about that time that I started that job, a National Guard outfit out of Detroit had been called to active duty, and at that time they had approached all the reserve officers in the Detroit area and had offered us a immediate promotion of one grade if we'd go on active duty with them. I politely turned them down. And in the following year, in February, I got a notice from Uncle Sam that I should put my affairs in order and report the following month to Fort Sheridan, and found myself assigned to the 210th Coast Artillery. And strangely enough, Colonel Gleim apparently had a pretty good memory and recognized my... Also, at one of the officers' meetings, there was a request made for suggestions of how we might improve the public appearance or attitude toward the outfit, and I had boldly made the suggestion that perhaps one of the things that should be recommended would be that maybe the officers, or at least some of the officers in the outfit, should be instructed while we were on practice convoy runs not to throw their empty beer bottles out on the highway. Therefore, I realized I was probably not going to be too welcomed in the outfit, so I heard that they were asking for volunteers for service in Alaska. So I immediately put in for a transfer, was not at least bit surprised at the rapidity of which my request was taken care of. And therefore, in August, around the 1st of August, I left Fort Sheridan with orders, I mean, to report to Seattle, and hence to Points North. When I got home up in the Sioux to say goodbye to my mother, I was a little taken by her first words to me. Why, Gene, has the Army gotten hold of you? I thought, Mother, I've been wearing this uniform now for about 3 months. So I thought, yeah, I guess they've gotten a hold of me. I've been getting a check from them now for several months. On further questioning, I found out that there apparently was a telegram for me that they had wanted to deliver, but it would not leave with her. So, inasmuch as the Western Union was only a short walk from my mother's apartment, I went down and asked if there was a possibility that I could get a copy of this thing. The manager was a kid I'd gone to school with, and Glenn said it would take a few little while, but he thought he could accomplish that fact. So, well, Glenn and I went up a couple of doors to Taffy's and had a couple. His crew started to work on trying to locate the telegram that was supposed to be delivered to me. And, of course, it was one of those saying, cancel such and such order number. I mean, you are granted three more days travel time, report to San Francisco. And therefore, I was pretty sure that I was not going to Alaska from San Francisco, so I returned to my wife's home in Coopersville, unpacked my woolies and packed my summer things, and reported to San Francisco. And wound up out in a godforsaken place called the Philippines. I had vaguely knew where it was. I was being a stamp collector. I had some idea where the damn place was. But having a commission in the artillery or the anti-aircraft, I mean, I figured that probably Uncle Sam was going to give me an AA gun to protect the steel plant and the Ford Rouge plant. But I had forgotten that they also manned some guns out on places called Cregador and other points. And as I stepped off the President Pierce, I mean, I ran into, very shortly, I ran into a young fellow who I knew who had been stationed at Port Brady, my home up in the Sioux, and Captain Peril. I had even had dated my sister on several occasions, so I knew him quite well. And I wondered, and he looked at me and said, "What in the hell are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, I wish I knew, but here I am, and what are you doing?" And I found out that Chuck was the provost marshal off the Manila Bay area. And Chuck said, "Well, Scotty, as soon as you're settled," why, he said, "give me a call and I'll take you on a tour of Manila." I thought that sounded interesting, so I took, several weeks later, I took Chuck up on that. I'll touch on this matter a little later. Our first, we were put up in the Manila Hotel, and we're told that one of our first duties was we were each going to have a 10-minute conversation with Big Mac. And 2 days later, why, I had my 10-minute appointment with Mac, and he was questioned my background, and I told him about I was a graduate chemical engineer from Michigan State, had worked at the Great Lakes Steel Plant, and so on and so, and he informed me that he knew just where I would fit into his scheme of things. And but he was also interested in telling us that he had orders from Mr. Roosevelt to be sure and have the port of Manila ready to receive a supply ship, one supply ship a day, beginning November 1st. And I was curious at that comment, because I said to the general, I said, "Well, General, what are they planning to send you?" And he said, "Everything that we need to defend these islands." And I said, "Well, that..." I wondered where they were going to get it, because I said, "I have just come from duty with a National Guard outfit that has been on active duty now for a little over a year. And when we go on practice, and when we went on practice convoy runs, I had to mount 2x4s in the bed of a truck to assimilate 50 caliber machine guns. So I just wondered just exactly what a troop ship or a supply ship a day was going to bring us, I mean." Needless to say, I think probably all of you know how many of those ever reached the Philippines. I was assigned to, the 59th Coast Artillery over on Corregidor, and assigned to Battery D, which was a 12-inch barbette gun, one of two, I would say, modern armaments that was on Corregidor. Modern in the extent that they had been brought over from Hickam Field in 1898. But at least they were the most practical gun that that existed on Corregidor. They fired a 975-pound armor-piercing projectile, supposedly about 30 miles. I think that was stretching it. I think if we say 27, we'd be closer to the actual range of that Betsy. But Betsy would fire. I mean, she proved to me that if I put the right information into her, by God, she'd hit what I was aiming at. Actually, during the war, we only got two opportunities to fire at anything that was moving on the water. I mean, and that happened to be a couple old dilapidated ships and a tug once that were pulling some barges down the coast of Bataan toward their base over on Cavite, I mean. And we pretty well made matchwork of them. Opportunities to fire the gun were very limited, but I did find out the one thing that I was able to locate a map down in the engineering department to the same scale that my plotting board was. And I mounted that on the plotting board, got permission to fire a few orientation rounds, and found out that I could keep the men busy by taking the armor-piercing fuses out of those shells and putting point detonating ones in. And we could fire at targets over in Bataan. And we did get a few Jap convoys coming down along the east coast of Bataan, and the engineering department enjoyed our work, because they said we not only took care of the convoys, but we dug a hole big enough so they just had to push them aside. The west coast of Bataan, I tried numerous times trying to hit targets over on that thing, but there was a stinking Mount Marvellous sitting right there in front of me, and I took at least 20 feet off the top of that damn thing trying to get over the top of it, but I Betsy just wouldn't go over the top of the damn thing. Preparation, when I arrived in September on Cregador, seemed to me to be a matter of how the particular commander of the particular battery felt about the oncoming conflict, whether it was going to be one or whether there wasn't going to be one. And my illustrious commander, Snoke, class of 38 out of West Point, was one of those who apparently was positive that the Japs wouldn't have guts enough to attack the United States. But we did have practice alerts, and the week before Thanksgiving, the men were ordered from their barracks up on topside to take up permanent quarters down at the battery, and the officers were told to report every morning at 7 o'clock, and two of us had to rotate each night, and be on duty during the entire day, or the entire evening. About that time also, I received a call from a Lieutenant Faft, who I had met out of the University of Missouri, who had gone over with me on the President Pierce, and had been assigned to MacArthur's USAFE staff. And he had invited me to come over and have Thanksgiving dinner with him. Being the last officer to be assigned to that particular outfit, I knew I was going to get the duty on Thanksgiving Day, so I said I had to pass on that, but would it be possible I could come over on the weekend? So he said, well, that'd be great. So I went over and Saturday and met Faft at the Army-Navy Club. He had in his company a couple of Filipino broads, that he said were daughters of a couple of officers in the Philippine Army, he introduced me to. We had a couple of drinks at the club, went over and watched the high-low club action for a while, and about 7:30 drove down to his quarters, and his Filipino help had prepared a very lovely meal, and we enjoyed that, and then rolled up the rugs and did a little dancing and other things, about 12 o'clock took the girls back home, and we came back to his quarters, and Faft told me, he said, Scotty, I got some bad news to tell you. And I said, well, great, what is it? Well, last Tuesday, the last units of the Japanese fleet sailed from the Northern Islands of Honshu with full battle complements heading east. Well, it's been my opinion ever since that if a young second lieutenant in MacArthur's staff knew that, the War Department and the Army and everybody else must have known it also. And I don't think that in any stretch of the imagination we thought they were going out to fish for whatever kind of fish they catch out in the North Pacific. I happened to be on guard duty the night of that the war broke out, and I remember I had just made my rounds and came back when the telephone rang, and I received this message: alert all batteries, war has been declared with a Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. This is not a practice. I repeat, this is not a practice. Oh, I told my telephone operator to ring up the batteries and give them the message, and I went into the little anteroom and awoke the colonel, and he sort of propped his head up on one side and said, I gave him the message I had received, and he said, young man, when will you learn what is real and what isn't? And I said, well, they assured me that this was real, so he soldered out, grabbed the telephone, cranked up down at Malina Tunnel, apparently got the same information, and went over to the telephone operator and said, alert all batteries, and he was informed that he already had taken care of that on the lieutenant's instructions. We had been enthralled during those months prior to the war with our illustrious regimental commander's tales that there were air currents around Cregador, that would prevent the Japs from ever bombing Corregidor. They would take their bombs out to the China Sea. They'd never be able to hit Corregidor. And believe me, I mean, we began to wonder for about 3 weeks whether he had gotten that message through to the Japs, because their planes kept coming in and veering off to other targets, but they never hit Corregidor. Never dropped a bomb on Corregidor, and we began to wonder, maybe he knew more than we did about what those air currents were capable of doing. And unfortunately, on the 28th of December, I had a couple of my enlisted men up at the topside ordnance depot getting a couple of guns and a pistol repaired when the Japs decided to hell with those air currents and they started to bomb the hell out of Corregidor. And one of the first bombs that hit a storage shed just on the edge end of the ordnance depot where we were, which had a large amount of 30 caliber ammunition stored in it. Well, my two enlisted men and I made a quick dive for a ditch and started to crawl. And each Christmas, I get a Christmas card from my supply sergeant, one of the few survivors of my outfit. It always contains the P.S. Keep your head and your ass down and crawl. Which he insists when he asked me what we were supposed to do, that was my instructions. Well, that's exactly what we did. We kept our head and our ass down, and we crawled and made the protection of an anti-aircraft battery. And during the bombing, I mean, helped carry ammunition to the guns, I mean, since I couldn't get back to my own battery. Afterwards, I had, the bombing was over, I thought it would be expedient at least to, I wanted to go down and see what was left of Corregidor, because the barracks at topside were pretty well demolished, and a good many other landmarks were pretty well taken care of by the Jap bombing, and so walked down past the hospital, which had also had been damaged, and around the bend, and there were a line of 12 duplex-type apartments, and mine was the one right at the bend. And all that was left of my quarters was a bathtub that was hanging up there by three pipes. I asked for volunteers because there was a prize up in that bathtub. When I had come back from my visit with Paft, I had brought with me from Manila a case of scotch, a case of rum, and a case of Canadian Club. And they were in the bathtub. Less what we had consumed in the interval, I mean. But there was a good deal left. I got a couple volunteers. I mean, by God, would you believe, only two bottles were destroyed. The rest of it was still intact. I became a very popular individual on Corregidor, I mean. But it was certainly a matter of only time, I mean, of what was going to happen. And I think all of us knew what it was, what was going to become of us. I mean, that we were not going to ring by enemy aircraft. We were not going to survive too long, I mean, and we had, I was actually, I mean, I was over on Bataan the night that at our signal stations to direct the fire for our gun along at the land targets that we could shoot at, and I noticed a rather large explosion to my rear, and I realized that the ammunition dump was being blown. So I told my three enlisted men, let's get the hell out of here. We had already had the station well mined, so I had already reconnoitered a path down to the shore, and I got down there to the shore and with my walkie-talkie and hid in the bulrushes and kept calling my battery over on Corregidor. Unfortunately, one of the officers over there was a kid by the name of Lieutenant Hodson, who was a pretty good sailor. By God, if Hodge didn't go down that night, confiscate one of the native bunkers, and sail the damn thing across over to, I told him I was over near one of the aiming points of the gun, and he knew where that was. And by God, he's brought that damn thing over, picked us up, and took us back. And about a quarter of the way back toward Corregidor, the moon came out in full view, and believe me, if any group ever did one hell of a lot of praying, it was that group, because as we looked down there, we could see those damn mines, and it didn't look like they were more than 6 inches below the boat. But we made it back to Corregidor for what that was worth, and so I at least was not required to make the death march. But it was obvious to me, I mean, that we might as well prepare for what was coming, because we were ringed now with artillery, I mean, on Bataan and Cavite on the south shore, and everything on Corregidor was buried in concrete. There wasn't anything movable, only there were a couple of 3-inch guns, I mean, but nothing of any caliber. Everything was buried like mine was. I mean, it was buried into a concrete pit. The hill had been moved down so that I had sort of a hill in back of me, and I was able to camouflage the gun. I cut down a lot of trees, I mean, and put them along the platform, so I had a fairly good camouflaged gun. And fortunately, I mean, Battery Smith was one of the ones that, I don't know, they just never saw it, but at least they never hit the damn thing during the war. I mean, they came close a couple times, but they never did any damage to the gun, I mean. But it was obvious, I mean, what was going to happen very shortly, and certainly a month later, why, we got the word that of the surrender, I mean, so, and to destroy the gun. So what I did is I took 10 of the powder cans, dumped the powder down in the pit of the gun, got 2 55-gallon drums of aviation gas and poured that in there, then got up on the hill and fired a machine gun down there until I had a pretty good fire. And I melted every gear in that poor old gun, and all of a sudden she went kerplop, and down she went into the pit, I mean. And I often wondered, I mean, pretty sure the Japs never got much off of that cut and thing gun. The mate to mine, Battery Hearn, was left intact, and I heard afterwards that they actually tried to get the thing back into firing shape and got it what they thought was back into firing shape, but apparently never had guts enough to put a shell in and see whether it actually was still fire. My first encounter, I mean, after the surrender, when we were marched down to what was a small airfield that would on Corregidor that would handle a Piper Cub, nothing much bigger, I ran into a Jap who wanted to, apparently he knew a little English and I had learned a little Japanese, and I gathered with his conversation that he wanted to know if I had a picture of my wife, and I took it out and I showed him a picture of my wife, and he gave me one whack across the arm and he said, "You damn fool, why don't you stay home?" I wondered at that moment why I had. They quartered us up on along this airstrip, and I made a decision, and I, to this day, I can't tell you why or what prompted me to make it, but something told me that it didn't make any difference whether I had bars on my shoulder or I was the lowest private in the United States Army. The Japs were not going to make any difference. It didn't make any difference to them which one I was. So I lined up the battery one morning and told them, the men, I said, "Now it's your time to make a decision." I said, "All the officers feel that they're going to be segregated from you," and I said, "but something tells me that is not going to occur." So I said, "Now it's up for you to decide." I said, "Would you like me to stay with you, and we'll try and keep the outfit together? And if we stay together, maybe we can fare better as a group than we can individually." And I said it was up to them to decide. And My first sergeant, a big 6'7" Swede out of the coal mines of Pennsylvania, stood up and said, "You've heard the lieutenant, and I think that he has a good point that we all stick together." And he said, "Any dissenters?" There was one raised his hand, and so Swede went over and sort of grabbed him by the back of the neck and said, "Goodbye, Carl." So we managed, I eliminated any indication of any insignia that I had, and became just one of the boys. But I was able to keep the cotton picking group together. I figured by that time they sort of knew a little bit about me, and I thought I knew a good deal about them. And so our next stop, they loaded us on a boat and took us over to along Dewey Boulevard, made us wade ashore, and marched us down Dewey Boulevard to Santo Tomas Prison. And a couple days later told us they were going to start taking details out. So I got the men all lined up with my first sergeant in front and me at the tail end of it, and they started counting out a detail. And just about halfway between my outfit, they decided they'd had their 3,000 men, so they stopped. So the next morning, I made damn sure I had the remnants of my battery right up there in the front. So we got out with the first group, and fortunately, we ended up with the rest of the gang 2 days later. As a result of that maneuver, I ended up at Cabanatuan Camp Number 2, which was about 15 kilometers east of the town of Cabanatuan, in a camp that had 6,000 enlisted men and 32 officers, instead of Cabanatuan Camp Number 1, which had about 4,500 officers and 1,500 enlisted men. It was needless to say, as I say, what prompted me to make that decision, I still can't tell you why. If I had a vision at night or what it was, but it certainly was a smart one. One of the first things, we came down to prison camp, all came down with yellow jaundice. I was sitting outside my barracks one night when one of my young enlisted men came up and said, "Could he talk with me?" And I said, "Why, sure, come over, Art." Art was a little kid with a sixth grade education who was to prove an invaluable asset to us, to me, in the months ahead. And he said, "Come on now, Lieutenant," he said, "you've gotten us through this damn thing so far." He said, "If we just stick together, we're going to make it," he said. "So now, cheer up." Well, when I lay down on my bamboo slats that night, I thought, well, my God, if a young kid with a sixth grade education's got this thing figured out, well, you better be smart enough to figure it out yourself. So, by God, the next morning, first thing, I went to Colonel Hopkins, who was a senior officer, Marine colonel out of our camp, and said, "I guess you better put me to work." He said, "Well, great. Well, one of the things we got problems that you might as well go to work on, Scotty, is that we got to learn how to cook this damn crud that the Japs are giving us for food." Now, I'd seen my mother cook rice in a double boiler. That didn't seem to. But cooking rice in a 35-gallon cast iron qualy over an open fire presented some new problems. But being a chemist, I hooked up with a young kid who was out of the Air Force, who had been a cook in the Air Force, and he seemed to have a little bit more knowledge than some of the rest of them. And we started trying out various things, and I took copious notes of just exactly what we did each time, because most of the time we either ended up with a pot full of rice that was like what we call lugal, was a cereal, or it was burned on the bottom and raw in the middle and not edible. And so we started trying various methods, and things, and as I say, I kept making notes of just what worked and what didn't. After about 4 days, my God, Rosen and I, we turned out a cast iron quality of rice, every grain of it. There was a little crust on the bottom, very bottom of the quality, but the rest of it was just as nice and fluffy, and you could eat every single grain off the rice. Rosen was made mess sergeant, and we started working with all the rest of them to tell them exactly how it was that you could cook a pot of rice and get the damn rice, all of it, out of the thing. That was a major accomplishment. It was one of these evenings, the only time really that during my stay in prison camp that I really got worked over, I mean by any of the Japs. One morning we were overdrawing our morning ration, and that night we had heard all the Japs' trucks move out of camp, I mean, and that night some of these little Igorudis, which I had met a few of them on a maneuver before the war, had gone apparently on the war path. They stood in the shadows and then went, and when a Jap came to see what it was, and they disappeared. When we were overdrawing our ration the next morning, the remnants of the two guard companies were brought back into camp. There weren't many. But one was lying on the tailgate of the, one Jap was lying on the tailgate of the truck pretty badly cut up. And I, like a good Samaritan, went over to help him get off the tailgate of the truck to the Japanese hospital, and I got worked over by a Jap guard with a rifle butt and told him to mind my own damn business. If he couldn't get to the hospital by himself, he might as well die there, but no use of having him dirty up the hospital, which certainly taught me a lesson of what they I could figure out what they thought about my hopes of survival or how they were going to treat me. They started immediately starting taking work details out from camp and sending them off to various places to work. Some of them killer details. I mean, the men that were taken down to build airstrips at Nichols Field and near Cavite, I mean, more of them died than survived. And other details were taken out. There was a group of 35 men and an officer that was taken back to Bataan. They were going to find the tunnel that led between Bataan and Cregador. And despite anything that we said that such a thing did not exist, and the fact that if it had, why didn't we all the troops around Bataan, why didn't they make it back to Cregador? Why, was to no avail. They were going to find the damn tunnels. And they kept that detail out on Bataan for almost a year and a half, searching for that damn tunnel. Apparently, it was a heck of a good detail, I mean, because they could scrounge for additional food, and it kept them out of any action, I mean. But shortly after that time, as the details were taken out, it was decided that they would combine Commander 1-2 with Commander 1-1, and we were marched down to the other camp. And those of us who had been working in the kitchen were told we would be split up among the kitchens at this camp. And we drew straws as to which who would have first draw, or mean choice. I drew the short stick, there was one guy who had charge of one of the kitchens whose reputation had gone before him. He was a... Apparently, I mean, Fitch was supposed to be a prime son of a bitch. I mean, but I went down, and when I drew the short, I just immediately walked down and reported to Fitch. I said, I'm your boy. And we sat down, had a conversation. He told me how we ran the kitchen, and I said, fine, sir, that's great with me. And I must say, strangely enough, I lasted with him long after any and all the rest of them had... part of their other company, I mean, because he happened to be a delightful individual out of West Point, class of 32. A delightful, I found a delightful person to work with. I knew what I was expected to do, and as long as I did it, why, that was okay. And if I made a decision, and it was something that had been established, he never once changed my decision. couple times he came down in the evening and said, Scotty, if some of this, such a problem comes up again, he said, I'd suggest maybe you look at it from this point of view. And I agree that if I probably had, it would have been a much better solution than the one I picked. But never once was my decision reversed. But, and so we, I started working again in a kitchen, and I guess probably I am probably the only person in the United States Army who has been awarded the Legion Merit because of the fact that said he put a little knowledge of chemistry to good use to make 1,500 men more comfortable. We needed another supply of oil to fry, because I wanted to try and fry things for some of the troops. And the amount that the Japs gave us was very limited. So I put up a sign, I mean, in the kitchen that I, was there anybody have a suggestion? Well, a captain who had been head of the Manila Transit system and who was now taking care of the power plant over on the Jap side came over one night and said, Scotty, he said, no way you can get lots of oil. He said, the Japanese diesel fuel is nothing more than coconut oil with a little kerosene added to it. And he said, can you get rid of the kerosene? Sure. So I got a sample off it, and I went to work one night, and I tried to remember my organic chemistry, so I poured it into one of the qualies and dumped in all the Komodi peelings that we'd had from that day and some rotten greens that had been issued also, and boiled it up. And I boiled it for about an hour. Then I made myself a filter and filled it up with the charcoal from the fire pit and poured the product down over the charcoal, and you could hardly taste the kerosene. So I ordered all the truck drivers, I mean, any time they found a piece of pipe or anything along the road, pick it up and bring it in. And fortunately, about 50 feet below my kitchen, there was a culvert run across to the Jap side of the compound, and we gradually pieced the pipe together. And on a prearranged signal, after we got it from one of my truck driver friends over there, Little Art, I went over and drained off 15 gallons of the Japs' diesel fuel, and after I had fed the troops, I went to work refining the diesel fuel so I had oil to fry things with the next day. I'd also made requests of the Japanese to give us some flour. I wanted to try and do some baking for the men, because it was the one thing that we didn't have. Apparently, someplace down around Manila, they ran across a warehouse in which was stored 140-pound sacks of corn flour, Australian corn flour, unadulterated cornstarch. And God, we started getting 140-pound sacks about every 3 days. And if you have little sugar, you can make one heck of a lot of cornstarch pudding out of a 140-pound sack of cornstarch. And it kept piling up there, and I practically knew without reservation, I mean, that my greeting in the morning when Fitch came down would be, Scott, what are you going to do with that damn cornstarch this morning? And I'd say, well, cornstarch pudding. Well, you don't use much of it that way. One night when I was lying on my burlap bags into the kitchen, down to me, wondered if there was something I could do with that damn cornstarch, so I asked the colonel if I could take a little of the rice ration the next night. And he said, what are you going to do? I said, well, I'm not quite sure, Fetch, but I said, maybe we can use up some of this cornstarch. One of the things that I had, when I, time of the surrender, the doctor had given me a bunch of pills, and one of them was a large bottle of brewer's yeast tablets. I had one of these old milk cans, I mean, that the farmers used to put out on the road when the truck came along to collect the milk. I had put those things in, and I had them up by one of the stoves, and I had kept this wild yeast mixture going by adding a little, if I had a little sugar, and it was yeast. I had to watch it pretty closely because my cooks that came on early in the morning like to fortify themselves with a little of that juice, I mean. But he decided that I guess we could, he said, "You got a glint in your eye, Scotty." I mean, so he said, "Go ahead and take a little." So I took a little of the rice ration that night and cooled it. And after I'd fed the troops, why, I poured in about 15 cupfuls of this wild yeast mixture, put it up by the stove, and put a cover on it. And about every 15 minutes, I took a peek. Nothing was happening. So I read a few more pages of Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire and looked again. About 12 o'clock, I opened the cover, and by God, there were a couple of little bubbles coming up. And I said, "Bravo, bravo." So I stirred it a little more. And by about 2 o'clock, I had a gooey damn mess of rice in that pot. And I started adding canteenfuls of cornstarch. And I found out, oh God, I could add cornstarch. And I mixed this up, and I had the gooeyest and looking mess, I mean, like a dough of some kind, I mean, and I put it on the table and pounded it out, got a can and started cutting out donuts and threw it in some of their refined diesel oil, and by God, I had something that looked like a donut. And by God, at one point in time, I was producing about 10,000 fritters a day, I mean, and I used up not only all my cornstarch, but I used up all the cornstarch from every other kitchen, except one that refused to give it to me because he was going to find out what the hell I was doing with it. And but he never did. I found out what I was doing, but never did find out where I was getting my oil to accomplish this marvelous feat, I mean. Many years later, when we were having dinner together in the Palmer House, I mean, Major Packard said, or Major Johnson said, he said, "Now, finally," he said, "Scotty, it's time that you told me. I mean, where in the hell did you get the grease to fry with?" I said, "Well, I guess by now, I guess I could tell you." So I let him know in on the secret. I mean, Japs had also had a farm detail, and we were growing corn, and it did very well. What we didn't know was that what we had planted was field corn. And it grew very well. I mean, and the first harvest came in, and of course, with corn, what naturally think corn on the cob. So boy, when the first harvest came in, we were going to really treat everybody to corn on the cob. Well, after about 2 days, the medics were over in the kitchen saying, "Cease and desist. We can't treat the cases of dysentery that you're creating by feeding the troops corn on the cob." Well, question remained. I mean, we still had all this corn, and what were we going to do with it? I remembered one night at the paternity house that they had served me something that they called hominy, and they told me it was made from corn. So I put up another sign down in the kitchen. Did anybody know anything about how you made hominy? And by God, a major mover from down in Mississippi came down one night, and he said, "Scotty," he said, "I've seen Mammy make hominy many times." I said, "Sit down, boy, and tell me all the details." So he told me how you husked it off the shell, and you put it in a lye solution, and you boiled it, then you washed it, and then you fried it. Okay. So by God, we started hulling some of the damn stuff. A lye solution, I figured that was easy. All I had to do was take the ashes out of the fire pit, pour in some water, and I had a lye solution. So Some of the hull corn I started pouring into the lye solution, and my God, that outside hull disappeared, and instead of just a little kernel of corn, I had a great big kernel. So I tried. And he tried it and said, "My God, Scotty, what is this?" And I told him, "Well, it's hominy. I mean, he's made out of the corn." Well, from then on, by God, we hulled the corn, and I became very popular. Our kitchen was popular because I asked you to come through with two mess kits. We gave you one mess kit of hominy and one mess kit of rice and the other stuff that the Japs had given us. I mean, we became very popular, and we could eat the hominy. That didn't cause any disturbance to our digestive system. We could eat that without any problem at all. We had, Japs knew nothing in the way of sanitation but slit trenches, and when you have, after a short length of time, that becomes a rather acute problem, and flies became a very, despite the fact of offering a little extra ration, I mean, if you brought in 1,000 flies, it still was a case of trying to keep the flies away while you use the other hand to get it up to your mouth. I mean, whatever it was that we were able to give you. Colonel Saint, who had headed our engineering department, came up with the bright idea that perhaps we could build a septic tank. So he had approached Colonel Bunker about the fact. I mean, I wonder if we could build a septic tank. And so Colonel Bunker said, "Well, what is your problem?" He said, "Well, getting a culture is the biggest problem." He said, "I can construct one." So Colonel Bunker said, "Well, you better go over and call on our resident chemist." He said, "Scotty has had the answer. Oh, everything else," he said, "why don't you go over and talk to him? I mean, maybe he'll tell you how we can get a culture going." So we gathered up a good deal of caribou dung and mixed it with some more of my wild yeast mixture. Stirred it up. And by God, we and Colonel Saint built his 10-seater, and we got the damn thing going, and it worked. And we could flush it with a 55-gallon drum of water, which cleaned it out, and boy, we just had a little effluent of clear water running out of the doggone thing. He invited the Japs over to inspect this miracle, and immediately the answer was, "Get rid of the damn thing, that's black magic." And they were not going to have any part of black magic in camp. There was something strange about how you could get this thing to work. But Colonel Saint was persistent and said that we could get rid of the flies, that we could do it. And he volunteered even we'd go over and build a couple of them on the Japanese side for them first. So we did. And amazingly, I mean, we were allowed to keep the damn things. And within sight of 2 months, I mean, we actually had been able to clear up the damn fly population in great shape. You could eat your meal without having to try and get the flies away. The ration was buried, I mean, in our treatment room. And the information that we got when we first got into prison camp, the Japs were very liberal with giving us the Manila paper to read and some of their papers, because we wondered about it at the time, because why it was. They never sank anything but a battleship or an aircraft carrier, and we were curious of how in the hell you were turning them out so fast over here. They never sank a destroyer or a cruiser or anything. It was always a battleship or an aircraft carrier. And we had, the one thing that lacked in our diet was, of course, protein. Not far from the camp, before the war, had been a big Philippine Army agricultural station where they were breeding, or crossbreeding, caribou and the Brahma bull. And when war came, that entire herd had been turned loose. And as much as we wanted that protein, we finally talked the Japs into taking some of our so-called butchers out, and they would go out and we would stock some of these caribou and then let them, they would shoot them and then we'd carve them up and they'd bring the meat back to us and we'd have meat in our ration. That worked fine for about 3 weeks until one morning a very prized bull went past and a Jap picked up his gun and let go two shots and Captain Orr grabbed the damn gun from him and felled him with one shot. You don't let the Japs lose face. I mean, that was the end of going out and shooting any caribou. So, I mean, the next step was we decided, we talked them into, would they let us, we'd take all our cowboys from down south out there and we'd rope them and bring them back in and put them in an area right adjacent to camp, I mean, and we'd have a corral over there, and then it was even better because now we could butcher them right there, and we'd get everything. And by God, I learned to cook tripe, I learned to cook brains, I learned how to cook any cut and pick and part of an animal so that it was edible. I don't know today whether these recipes would be so good or not. At reunions, I am often asked, I mean, wouldn't you like to quantus up some of those fritters? And I'm afraid maybe today they might not taste half as good as they did then. But at least, as I said, I probably am the only officer that was awarded the Legion of Merit because he used a little knowledge of chemistry, I mean, to make a few men happy. As the, we had been mighty unhappy with one officer who was with us, a Marine colonel by the name of, major by the name of Pisac, who had served several times as our military attaché in Tokyo, because he had told us when we got into prison camp that we might as well learn to like this because we were going to be here for a while. In fact, he said, 3 or 4 years. We said, oh, you Jap-loving so-and-so, I mean, the heck we're going to be here for any length of time like that. I guess very few of us realized how close to accurate his estimate of the situation was. Of course, the main path of camp was Broadway. And one of my officer's friend, Lieutenant Hudson, the one who had come over and picked us up off of the tan, and I were walking up the Broadway one morning when Hodge suddenly grabbed me by the shoulder and said, listen. All right, listen. I could hear planes approaching. I said, yeah, planes coming in. And Hodge said, yes, planes coming in. He said, but those aren't Jap planes. I looked at him and said, don't be foolish. I mean, we haven't seen anything but Jap planes. What kind of planes are we going to see? Well, that was the first contingent of Halsey's dive bombers that had. Apparently, they had an approximate idea where the camp was, and they were going to make that their rendezvous point before they took off to various targets throughout the Philippines to bomb. I mean, they missed us by about They were about 20 miles to the south of us. But I often wondered, I mean, Hodge, because he said he sure those weren't Jap, because he said that he insisted the Jap Zero sounded like a Maytag washing machine, and these didn't, so he knew they were not Jap planes. Those details, after they'd rendezvoused, took off to their various targets. And the group that had gone directly east to hit Clark Field came back, and on the return plate, why, they circled right overhead so we could get a good view. I mean, and we began to wonder, because the insignia had been changed, just who the damn plane it did belong to, I mean. But a rear fighter escort that was accompanying the bombers decided to give us a real view, so he took a dive down and came down about 100 feet off the ground, right down the four corners of the camp. And I Many years later, I happened to meet that pilot in Racine, Wisconsin. I asked him on and told him, I said, I didn't know whether on, among his kill he had marked down one Jap. I mean, because a Jap in one of the guard towers saw that damn plane coming down, and he decided the ladder wasn't the way to get down. He decided to jump, and that's where they dug a hole for him. With the return of the American forces, of course, it became evident, of course, that probably that the prisoners were going to be moved, and we were first, what was left of us, were taken to down to Manila, and we had, at this time, I mean, we were still getting fairly good information as to what was going on regarding to the war. In fact, one of the officers had made a little radio, cut off the bottom of a canteen, put a plug on the bottom of it, and had built a little crystal set, and I had it in the back of the kitchen, and Friday evening I used to listen to the one KGEI's broadcast that was beamed directly toward the Philippines, and I would get the latest information, and also would, I had a pretty good musical ear, I would try and remember the tunes of the top 10 hit parade. And I often wondered why the Japs never caught on to the fact, I mean, that the band, when they played every week, used to play the top 10 hits of the United States. Mac was awful good. I would hum the tune, and by God, he would make an arrangement for the band to play. And each week, I mean, we had the top 10 hit parade on the program. I mean, we also were a little leery, I mean, in these programs that we had. I mean, one of the other things that we got in our first Red Cross supplies was some movies, I mean, and one of them was a Donald Duck. One of our Jap guards we had nicknamed Donald Duck because his scabbard, you could always tell where Donald had been because his scabbard hung down below there, and you could see that mark along the ground where he had been. And we were a little leery about showing that movie that cartoon that night because the Japs always came over and took the seat right down front. But fortunately, Donald Duck was one of those few Japs that had a little sense of humor, because the next day, he went around camp broadcasting, I mean, I big Hollywood movie star, I Donald Duck. After we were most, except the very sick, were taken out of Cabana One and moved to Manila. And there we were put up in the old Santa Tomas prison. And during that time, we could practically set our clocks. I mean, 7 o'clock, the Jap bombers took off in Hedgetop to the north and to the west. 7:30, Halsey's dive bombers came in, bombed the hell out of Manila and adjacent areas until 4 o'clock, took back to their carriers. 5 o'clock, the Jap bombers came back in and tried to find a place to land. And we could practically set our clock by the schedule. And it was during, of course, this time, I mean, that also the Japanese found out what a lousy port Manila actually was, I mean, because we had watched this action go on, and then the typhoon hit and drove Halsey out to sea to regroup. And during that time, the Japs brought in to Manila Bay 5 of their heavy cruisers. About 5 of those damn heavy cruisers on the bottom of Manila Bay. I mean, every one of them. I mean, they used to send out, every day we'd see them sending out new personnel to man the anti-aircraft guns, but the rest of them, they were just settled on Manila Bay. I mean, but about this time also, the way when the typhoon broke, the Japs managed to get a ship into Manila, and 1,913 of us were loaded on the Orioka Maru and headed north to Japan or someplace. Maybe you remember the name, Orioka Maru. That was the so-called hell ship. We got just past Cregador and around the bend of Bataan Peninsula. The next morning when Halsey's boys came back, and apparently in the translation, I mean through the underground, there was only a number on the stack of the ship, and the one we were on was number 14, but in somehow it getting information back to the American forces that had become 41, and the one ship that had 41 set off on our port side. And when Halsey came back, he didn't disturb 41, but on the first pass, I mean, he got a direct hit on the ship we were on. And we had been the ship was pretty badly crippled. At least its steering mechanism, and the Japs had just beached it about 1,500 yards off of our old naval station at Alangapool. They left us down in the hole of that ship without ventilation that night, and I have no idea, but it was many of Americans who took their own lives because they were suffocating down in that damn hole. And the next morning, Halsey was back, and the Japs had allowed us to get three boatloads of the wounded in the boats and lowered, along with some officers, when Halsey came back. He missed the ship on his first pass and got all three of the lifeboats. On his second pass, one of the kids on the deck got up and waved a white shirt at them, and they spotted it and took off, and the Japs allowed us to get off the damn ship as best we could. I'm not a marvelous swimmer by any manner of means, and that shore looked a long ways away. But what I thought of doing was I took about 20 canteens off of the dead Japs that were lying on the deck of the ship, put them through the straps of my musette bag, and I floated ashore. And as soon as I could get my feet on ground, I got rid of the Japanese canteens and walked ashore. That, with that musette bag, which contained a very priceless item, when it had become apparent that we were going to get moved out of Cabana de Juan in the Philippines, I had taken all the money we could, and we had bought up any corn that we could, and I had made something that with corn and salt and water and let it dry in the sun, and I had something that was closest to hardtack. I mean, you could have probably pounded nails with the damn stuff. How'd you could chew on a little piece of that damn stuff for a long time without getting rid of it, I mean, but that was what my musette bag was filled with, were these bars of hardtack, I mean, and fortunately that was what was to keep a couple of us alive for some time. But we were allowed to, they lined the shore with machine guns, and if you got out of the arc, well, they opened up with you with their machine guns, but I managed to make it ashore. They hoarded us on the tennis court at the naval station at Alangapool. We do not know, but off the 1,619 that had been boarded on the ship originally, during that brief encounter, probably at least 400 Americans had died or from the enemy action or had taken their lives themselves. We were given no food. Or the food that we were given was a sack of raw rice without any facilities to cook it, and That was what we sustained ourselves on. We were then moved in some closed box cars from Alangapool up to the San Fernando La Union and put up on Christmas Eve on the beach there, and the next day loaded onto two ships for another journey north. We made it as far as Takao in southern Formosa, and we were sitting in the harbor there when not Halsey, but the B-29s came over. There were 519 of us in the forward hold of the ship I was on when the B-29s came over, and one of them got a direct hit on the cross beams of the cover of the hole, and several near misses along the side of the ship, which just caved large sections of the plate of the ship, just bent it closed like a book. Off the 519 of us that were in the forward hold of the ship at that time, there were 29 of us that stood up that had two arms, two legs, and our heads where they still belong. I happened to be one of them. Captain Cummings was lying along this arm. He had a piece of shrapnel about the size of a meat platter through his side. Captain Cummings was lying along this arm. He had his head blown off, and I was in between them. I picked up how a plate of steel will rust, and I had picked up a number of pieces in my head and one piece in my leg. But I was one of those that still was among the living. We were then given no medical attention. How come I got no infection in that damn thing in my leg? I still don't know. I guess Rick said he told you last, I think I said somebody up there liked me a lot, and I don't know why, but I appreciate it. We were given no medical attention, and a few days later, those of us who were able were allowed to take those who had been killed in the attack to a crematory on Formosa, where their bodies were burned. And we were loaded on another ship and started toward Japan again. And we spent more time sitting in coves than we did in actual, I think, travel time. I think the actual trip from Manila to the southern island of Japan normally takes about 4 days on even a slow ship. It took us 31, because we sat in coves dodging our submarines and more times than we were traveling. But finally, on the 31st of January, we pulled into Moji, Japan. And just before the ship docked, the Japs came along and issued us a complete woolen set of American GI wools. An overcoat, pants, shirt, the whole damn works, and shoes. Most of us, of course, been many of them who Americans who had died, because all we had as far as clothing was our summer outfits that were being worn in the tropics or in the Philippines. It's all I had, but I had made a deal on the boat with a Jap. I offered him my wedding ring if he would sell me six of those straw mats that the Japs spread out to sleep on. He agreed. So I gave him my wedding ring, but he only gave me four of the mats. I found enough baling wire up in the various parts of the ship, to stitch those damn things together, and Fitch and I huddled with those things around us on the ship, and I think that's what kept us warm. And when we finally arrived at Moji in Japan, off the 1913 I'd originally had boarded, 407 of us left the ship. We were brought into a huge warehouse, and I vaguely remember, huddling up in my wool coat, and with Fitch, and I remember getting so mad at him because about every half hour, he made me get up and walk around. And I thought that was damn inconsistent of him. To make me get up and walk around, I was trying to catch a little shut-eye. Realizing now, of course, that it's what saved our lives, because if we hadn't, we'd have probably frozen to death, right there. I must have been in pretty sad shape because a couple days later, we were moved from Moji to Fukuoka, about 40 miles inland. Now, they tell me that we went on a train. We did. I don't have any recollection of that train ride, nor do I have any recollections of getting off that train. And Major Irons has insisted that when we got off that train that I carried him from the train station to the camp. And I have no more recollection of having done that, but I have met Major Irons a number of times. I was sorry to see that he, in our last issue of Quan, that he had passed away, but I've met him many times. And he will insist that I carried him most of the way to the camp. All I remember is coming up to a sort of a fence and a young boy coming and saying, "Let me help you," and taking me and getting me settled in a barracks and bringing me some chow. And I'm sure it was his ration as well as my own. And that was a young British officer, a young British boy, who since that time I have become well acquainted with. And John and I have visited many times. But John nursed me back to health so that I could stand up. And as I said, I'm sure during that time he fed me not only my ration, but his also, till I was able to again stand up and take care of myself. And we were stayed in Japan for about 3 months. And then the Americans and a few of the British officers, I gathered the British officers who had been a headaches to the Japs in Japan, were moved to Korea. I might mention just the fact that about this time, this was the one time during the entire our camp that we were given a celebration. And that was the night that the Japs heard that FDR had passed away and we had a new president by the name of Truman. That night we got double rations and they even brought in a band and the dancing girls and put on a show for us. We wondered who in the hell this guy Truman was, but somebody from Missouri, said they knew they had a senator by that name and that's probably who it was. It was also moved us down to the dock area. It was down there at the dock area that I ran into a young man who was on a stretcher and being carried, who has probably written what I believe to be the best account of prison camp life, and the book is entitled "Give Us This Day" by Charles Stewart. And it was Chuck that I talked to that night. We were then loaded on a ferry and taken over to Korea. Undoubtedly, Korea was our original destination, but the ship was in such bad shape that it had to be brought into Japan because it couldn't have made the trip to Korea. And we were taken to put up in a camp in Jinsin, or later known as Incheon. And it was here that we would be when the Japs. And someone asked me how we heard about the war. Well, about the end of the war. One One morning we were lined up and the colonel came out and told us that the war was over because we had dropped a bomb on Japan that was the equivalent of 10,000 B-29s. And we stood there and laughed like hell. We said, oh, sure we did. But you got tired of the damn thing and you decided to quit. Well, about a half an hour later, his executive officer came over. And one of the things that had happened back in the Philippines, after about the start of 42, then they had decided to recognize us as official prisoners of war, they had decided to pay us our rank in their army. And each month we got this allowance. But we had to take out a certain amount for board and room, and then there was another sum that was put into what they told us was the Japanese postal savings. And we had a little book and a little pork chop that had our name as best you could write it in Japanese, and we'd have to go over and stamp the book every month. Well, about a half hour after the announcement of the surrender, his executive officer came over, and by God, he had these little books. And by started paying us off what we'd accumulated in the Japanese postal savings in nicely, freshly printed yen. The ink wasn't still quite dry on the damn stuff. Realizing its real value, I mean, we threw the damn stuff in a box, and I remember my first instructions were I was to go out and get eggs. We wanted eggs. We were going to have eggs for breakfast. I walked around Incheon, and I found a Jap. He was carrying a slide rule in his pocket. My God, maybe I can talk to him, I mean. He can use a slide rule, maybe I can talk to him. And by God, the English that he knew and the Japanese that I knew, I found out where the farmer's market was. I mean, and I asked him where there was a Edo place, and he told me, I mean. So we went over first to the Edo place, and it had been closed up, but when we walked in, they decided they'd open it up. And we wanted something to eat, so we got our biru, but we wanted something to eat. So he excused himself, and a few minutes later came back with a fish, and we all shook our heads, yeah, cook it up. And by God, he cooked it up, and we ate the fish and the biru. I was very interested in the food, I mean, and I finally got a bang in the side. I mean, I turned to see that I had a feminine companion sitting next to me, I mean, and I was informed that things weren't quite ready upstairs, but if we'd come back that night, they would be. I also learned that they wanted to know if I would write out the word of what the English word for eating place was. So I wrote on a piece of paper I printed out the word restaurant, we serve beer. I don't know how long exactly we were in there drinking our biru and eating our fish. But anyhow, when we walked out, across the front of this damn place was a replica of a restaurant, we serve beer, and perfect replica of my printing, I mean restaurant, we serve beer. I also managed to find the farmer's market, and was told that I should not pay more than 25 yen or sen for a dozen eggs. But the farmer wanted a yen, so I said, to hell with it. If you'll give me a dozen eggs, I'll give you a yen. I didn't think it was worth anything to us anyhow. But I wanted Sanju Yako. I wanted 2,000 eggs. He looked at me, much to say, what in hell are you talking? And I shook my fist at him and I said, Sanju Yako. Yeah. Tomorrow. I come back tomorrow. I get about 500. I assign you luck. It took me about 4 days. By God, he came back with 2,000 eggs, and I took them, and I paid him in that nice, thrifty, pretty year. And we took it back to camp, and by God, for breakfast, we had scrambled eggs. And one other detail was sent out, and he came back with beef. I mean, so we had scrambled eggs, and then we had roast beef or beef or some kind of meat for supper. And also about this time, the B-29s had loaded up 55-gallon drums, two of them, and welded them together and filled them up with supplies and started to drop them to us. I mean, the first day they came over, why, they decided to try and drop them in the compound. Well, they practically destroyed our quarters, and besides got Captain Orr, I mean, and broke his leg. I mean, backed him up against a building and broke his leg, I mean, the damn thing. So we quickly gathered up the parachutes, made a huge target down on the beach, and the next day when they came back, why, we had them drop them down there. At least we had a place still to live, I mean. It was, of course, after 40 months of being cooped up, I mean, the Japs said, please stay in the compound. Well, that was about as useless as an ordeal or order to give as any. I mean, of course, what they realized now was that if anything happened to it, it was going to be their neck, I mean, because they couldn't just write us off anymore, I mean, so. But we took off. And I hit it, for one thing, I went down to the railroad station, and I noticed a train that had Vladivostok on the front end of it. Now, my grandpa had sailed into Vladivostok when he was a boy, and I'd heard tales of Vladivostok, so by God, I was going to Vladivostok. Now, I didn't have anything but my pockets jammed full of these damn yen. I had no sidearms. What I was thinking about, I mean, to get on a damn train, but I was going to, and a couple of my friends went along with me, I mean. We got about 50 miles north of Pyongyang and ran into the first Russians. We exchanged cigarettes with them. My friend said, Scotty, if you're going to Vladivostok, you're going by yourself, because we're going back and say hello to our wives before we go to Vladivostok. So I said, that sounds like the better part of valor, I mean. So I went back and never did get to Vladivostok, I mean. But we came back and it was actually, I mean, when we were picked up in Korea, finally, when the Second Army came ashore, I recall, I mean, that when Clark came ashore, why, I was standing on the hill with Fitch. Fitch was a captain down at San Antonio when Clark was a second lieutenant down there, but he apparently recognized, even in his emaciated condition, recognized Fitch and asked him what the conditions were in camp, and Fitch, I remember, responded like a pig pen. And I remember Clark turned to his aide and said, have these people evacuated? Well, within 3 hours, we were all out on a hospital ship. And I remember that Norderly coming saying, Captain or Lieutenant, if you have any wish, let me know. I mean, but I said, well, you could. One thing you could do for me, I said, you could call me about every hour. I said, I'd like to go in and have a nice hot shower. So by God, on the hour, he came and called me, and I went in and had a hot shower and went back and laid between those nice white sheets, and God, I thought I was... It was the only time I really, then I said, it was the one time I really got mad at Uncle Sam's Army and wished there was something I could do about it, because they asked us what we do, and I said, well, one of the first things I'd like to do, I'd like to send a message to my wife and tell her that I was on my way home. So I went up and sent a message to my wife, and I sent one to my mother, that I was back in American hands and I was on my way home, I hope. Well, we took a rather elongated journey, I mean, back, because on the way back to Manila, the hospital ship took us back so that we could see from about 12 miles out in the harbor what Yokohama looked like. And suddenly, there were a few of us that realized what he had meant when he said we had dropped a bomb that was equivalent to 10,000 B-29s. But we had been treated so well on that doggone hospital ship on the way back to Manila. We had been told that when we got hungry, we were to go down to the kitchen and there'd be some food for us. And I got acquainted with the dietitian on the ship. She had been a nurse from one of the hospitals in Detroit. And we had to put in, finally, that she told us, she said, we had to put in at Manila to resupply ourselves. Normally that had enough food on that ship to make the trip for an entire complement to Honolulu. But we had consumed so much, I mean, that we had to put in for supplies. When I got on that hospital ship, I weighed 87 pounds. And that was up from 82 pounds at the time of surrender. I mean, I had put that much on by the food that we had squandered ourselves. I mean, it was up to 87 pounds, but I was among the living, I mean. And if you can believe it, I mean, we got back in American hands and got down to Manila, why, and were put up in a base down there, why, outside of Nichols Field. I was in my compound when I heard a very familiar voice. His Captain Scott here. And I said, yes, and I recognized it was my brother-in-law. He had been, was with the Navy, and he had been watching all the ships that came bringing prisoners down, looking for Captain Scott, and he had a lengthy visit with me, in fact, stayed with me that night. Went back to his ship and sent my wife a telegram that he had seen Scotty, that he looked just as normal, he was just as ornery as ever, he looked just great, and he was on his way home to him. Very strangely, I mean, my father-in-law was a dentist out here in Coopersville, was talking on the phone to his supply house in Detroit when the operator out there cut in and said, Harry, you better hang up, I have word for you. That was the night that the Grand Rapids Press headlines were, Last American Prisoners Evacuated. And my dear wife had not heard anything about me. The folks were trying to keep the paper from her. And the operator said, and she said, and cut in on Dad, I mean, and said, and read him the telegram from Roger. Now, I had already sent one 3 weeks before that to my wife. About 4 days later, she got the one I had sent from Korea, I mean. But at least she knew I was, had his word that I was still among the living and was coming back home. It was to be, actually, of course, it was 50 months and 2 days from the time I had said goodbye to her in the wharf in San Francisco before I was to see her again in the Hammer House in Chicago. I kidded her. I told her to wear a rose in her hair and I'd know who she was in case I'd forgotten.